This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a sixth win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it is all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you along for the ride for the next hour on Sirius 216 XM 204, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and available anywhere you get your podcast each and every week, including on our HRRN website. Well, today's guest is in somewhat rarefied air. He is one of just a handful of trainers to make a third appearance here on Trainer Talk. His first coming shortly after we launched this show and about 10 years ago. His second on June 4th, 2017. And at that time, he had saddled 3,385 winners with purse earnings of right around $91 million. But as impressive as it is to appear three times on this show, it pales in comparison to this accomplishment, which occurred on August 10th in the eighth race at Saratoga.
The field now comes for the top of the stretch. And it is Isolate, challenged here on the outside by Repo Rocks. Mr. Phil is in third. And farther back is Southern District. It is Isolate who leads with a 16th to the finish. Isolate has a four-length lead, and this is going to be a milestone victory for trainer Tom Amos. Career win number 4,000.
John Embriel with that historic call. Tom Amos becoming the 15th trainer in the history of thoroughbred racing to reach the 4,000 win milestone. Tom, I have to tell you, I think that warrants a third appearance here on Trainer Talk. Congratulations, my friend.
Listen to John call that race. It still sounds as sweet as the day it happened back in August of this year.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Let's go back to that moment. Let's start there. Shortly after 5:08 Eastern, Isolate and jockey Tyler Gaffalione begin to pull away from the competition, and it becomes evident that you're going to join this exclusive club. Put me there with you. Where were you watching the race, and what was it like for you as you're watching this moment unfold?
Well, let's back it up a little bit, Mike. So I was sitting on 3,999 wins that week, and I had some opportunities to do it at other racetracks. Ellis was one, and certainly Horseshoe Indiana was the other. And I had a heavy favorite in at Horseshoe Indiana at the beginning of this day that ended up running second. So I didn't get it done there, and as the day wore on, it gets to be a bit tiresome of chasing this thing and not having it happen, and maybe almost a little bit embarrassing because everybody's paying attention and you're not getting it done. And how long are you going to make everybody pay attention? It's not something you want to do, not only to yourself, but to the people around you and to whatever media was covering it. So coming into Isolate's race, unbeknownst to me, because I do the shows, America's Day at the Races, the Saratoga Live shows, but I only do them Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And the reason I only do them 3 days a week is because it's very time-consuming, and I've got a more important job, a full-time job, and that's being a horse trainer. So on this particular day, it was a weekday. I was not doing the show that day. And to give you an idea of how involved those shows are, these shows are not scripted in what you say, but they're scripted down to the second of how much time you have and what the topics are going to be. And so it's a real tip of the cap to the people that produce it and work behind the cameras in putting this thing together. They're putting together 6 hours of television, and you know to the second when something is going to occur. I did not see what we call the rundown. It's basically an outline of the show for that day because I wasn't involved in it. So it wasn't until I got to the track later that day that I knew that they were going to follow me for Isolate's race if it was going to be, you know, potentially the 4,000th win. My wife Colleen was there, and so was my daughter Haley, my youngest daughter Haley, who works for the Breeders' Cup. She's in charge of their social media and does a lot of their PR for the Breeders' Cup, and she was up there covering some Win and You're In races. So I got to be with them. Unfortunately, my oldest daughter Ashley, who is the manager of the New Orleans Pelicans basketball team, she wasn't there. Today had started summer league in Las Vegas with the Pelicans, and so she couldn't be there. But anyhow, the three of us were there, and I felt the enormity of what was occurring. I had a camera on me saddling the horse. I was interviewed by Acacia Courtney before the race for the show. I had a camera on me as I was watching the race. And Isolate is a great sprinter, but he's one-dimensional. He needs the lead to run his best race. So when they broke from the gate, Isolate didn't break all that sharp. But Tyler put him in, you know, fourth gear immediately, and he was able to get to the front, but not without using some energy. So I became very concerned that his finish was going to be compromised by his start, which is often the case with speed horses if they have to use energy at the beginning of the race. Turning for home, a horse came to Isolate on the outside that had been saving his energy, and it looked like Isolate was going to get passed. And I was a little bit dejected internally as I watched, and more hopeful than thinking this was going to happen. But at about the eighth pole, Isolate shook that competitor off, and I realized, you know, at that point that I was going to win my 4,000th race. And a lot of things went through my mind, you know, Saratoga, of all the places to do it, in a stakes race nonetheless, was I couldn't have scripted it better. But, you know, as they crossed the wire, the thing that I've been thinking about for the week leading up to this was all the people that made that milestone happen. I had some very generous teachers as I was working my way up to be a trainer. Either other trainers that I worked for. I was a vet assistant for a year, which was a great learning experience for me. We got to deal with problems that trainers had with their horses that they didn't understand. I would look at two or three of those a day, every day. And so I thought about all those teachers, those people that knew that I wanted to be a trainer, that knew that I was there to absorb as much as I could from them. Jack Vanberg, Frank Brothers, Larry Robideau, the veterinarians I worked for, John Paracella in New York as a trainer as well. And I thought about all of them and how generous they were with their time. Hasn't ever been lost on me. I like helping young people in the business too. So they passed it on well, and I hope to pass it on to other people. But I thought about them, and I thought about my staff, all my staff. And of course, I thought about the owners that gave me the opportunity to train for them. So I didn't mention anyone specifically other than my wife and kids that made a lot of sacrifices along the way on my behalf. But certainly all those people, I didn't want to leave anyone out, were going through my head as Isolate was getting ready to cross the wire. And for John Embriale to give me a call out at the end of that race was, you know, that was the icing on the cake. So it was a great moment, maybe a sense of relief for a little minute, a lot of reflection afterwards. I'm getting maybe 61 years old. I'll be 61 in November. And definitely a sense of pride, that I did it the right way. That I always put the horse first. I never, ever tried to do anything to harm a horse. And I never tried to do anything to purposely cheat the system ever. And I take a lot of pride in all those things. And I was just really proud of the whole thing. And that night we went to eat dinner at the Wishing Well, the three of us, and the Wishing Well, it's a famous restaurant right outside of Saratoga. It's been there a long, long time. And the first time I went to it was when I was an assistant trainer for John Paracella, and an owner invited me to go, who was from New Orleans, James Stone, Jimmy Stone. And Jimmy took me to the Wishing Well along with my wife, Colleen, back in, that would have been 1987. And there's so much history in that restaurant as far as racing goes, and so many famous faces that are in there. When I won with Isolate, I called the restaurant and I asked if they could take us that night. And I wanted to relive it from back in the days where I was making, you know, only enough money to get by each week to where I was now. And we had a great meal there. And I enjoyed every second of it. You know, Saratoga and I don't want to be too long-winded here, but Saratoga, when I graduated from college in the summer of 1983, I asked if I could go to Saratoga for a week for my parents as a graduation gift, and they gave me a plane ticket to go up, and that was my first time to go to that track. I hadn't even started working full-time on the racetrack yet. I'd done part-time jobs, summer jobs, things like that, but I had not done anything on the racetrack. And to go to Saratoga and not having experienced a racetrack of that magnitude back in 1983 was such a different world to me. It truly was like playing, you know, recreational baseball and then being called up to the majors to see what it's like. And I never for a second thought that my destiny would be a 4,000th win in a stakes race at Saratoga at that time. I loved horses. I loved the process of training horses. And I just wanted to be a trainer someday. And for it to come all the way to that this summer in August, it just couldn't have scripted it any better. You know, and for me, someone that certainly believes in a higher power, who certainly believes in God, you know, I just think it was destiny for it to happen that way, as so many things in my life have been. And I'm not overtly religious. I don't pour that out to people every time I see them. But in this instance, it was another example of God reaching out and saying, you know, this is your moment, and you know, enjoy it, and hopefully use it constructively in the future. And I certainly want to do that.
Well, Tom, it's a wonderful recollection of what that moment meant to you, and I appreciate you going back even before the moment occurred. And you were quoted after the race as saying that you thought about your mom and dad, and I'm glad you brought them up, because when you were first thinking about getting involved in racing, they said, okay, you can do it, but hold on a second, you have to get a college degree first. So talk about that and what they meant in the early days of Tom Amos.
Yeah, so I come from a family of six boys, and you know, all are very accomplished, and were very accomplished students in school. My oldest three brothers all went to Yale. The oldest was a Rhodes Scholar after finishing up at Yale and, wow, and studied in Oxford. My next brother, my big brother, went to Duke, and he was a marine biologist, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in his 40s, a very cruel, cruel disease. I just lost my big brother, about a year ago. And, you know, he's the one that really raised me, because both my parents worked. My dad was a executive with a steamship company, and my mom was an author illustrator. And so she did her work in the mornings early upstairs in the house. And, you know, we would make our breakfast, we'd make our own breakfast, and I'd take the streetcar to school on a lot of occasions. You know, they didn't know anything about racing, nothing at all. And they knew it was my passion by the time I was in ninth grade. They were sure that that's where I was headed. And I let it be known that's where I was headed. But they said, they gave me some very sage advice. And at the time, I didn't think so. And they said, you can do anything you want, and we'll be behind that, but you have to get a college education. I had no interest. I wasn't a good student. I saw what life was like at the racetrack, and I wanted to get started. And in the end, I conceded, and I went to LSU, and it was the best 4.5 years of college that a person could have had. I grew up at LSU. I gained a lot of maturity at LSU. I was a member for being held a bunch of offices. I was the rush chairman, responsible for bringing the new kids in. I was the social chairman, but all those jobs, you know, were working with budgets and demanded a lot of time from you. And I grew up. I owe a great deal of credit to that fraternity, Sigma Nu. Fraternities get a bad rap about being party this and party that, and certainly we did our share back then. But in terms of working with a group of people, just like you would in any business, that's what we did. And so I grew up there, and I also learned the ability to converse with people better as an adult, as someone who, you know, could bring a point about to someone else about this or that. And I think that helped me in television as I moved on as well. And it certainly helped me in communicating to my owners. And I was a marketing major. I graduated with a degree in marketing, and I think that's helped as well. So my mom and dad, they followed my career. They don't know anything about horse racing, but a lot of my success was in New Orleans, which is where we were from. And they would get to see it or read about it in the paper there. And I'll never forget. I won a lot of races, but I didn't have that signature race, that Breeders' Cup win, that Derby win, whatever that. And I remember all the time saying at the end of the day when I put my head on the pillow, you know, God, I don't ask you for anything in racing. And I know you got more important things to do than that. But if there's a signature race out there for me, could you make it in my parents' lifetime? And that's the only thing I ever asked as far as horse racing goes. And when I won the Kentucky Oaks with Serengeti Empress, my mom passed away the following fall, and my dad passed away the following spring from COVID. Wow. So I got to fulfill it, and again, that just isn't a coincidence.
No, it's absolutely not. Talking with trainer Tom Amos here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. His third appearance here on Trainer Talk, one of just a handful of trainers ever to appear on this show three times. But when you reach the 4,000 win milestone in your career and you become one of just 15 trainers in the history of the sport to do so, you deserve to be on this show for a third time. And Tom, you mentioned your time at LSU, and you pleased your parents by getting that education that they requested of you before you went back and went full-time at the racetrack. You were even able to do that by overcoming a somewhat dubious roommate, I guess, in college.
Yeah, people ask us all the time, who was the bad boy and who was the good boy? I think the answer in private would be a lot different than what we say publicly. But my roommate was Al Stahl. His family introduced me to horse racing back when I was a kid. And it was coincidental because for a while Al was going to go to the University of Kentucky. And I was always going to LSU. And he switched, decided to go to LSU. And we weren't destined to be roommates at first because you have to fill out all these forms. And they were already done, and we were in different rooms. But when we got to school the very first day, we were like, you know, hey, we got to see if we can switch this up. So we were able to do it. We lived together our freshman year at Power Dorm. Power Dorm is no longer at LSU. I think they renovated and made it something nicer. But we spent a year together there. We've been lifelong friends. We were in grade school together, Holy Name. And then we got reacquainted when Al transferred to Newman High School, which is where I was, and we've been friends ever since. And of course, Al got his degree in geology. And by the way, when I went to Saratoga that year for graduation, Al came with me, so the two of us went up there together, even though he had a semester of school left. And he started off in geology; he's a geologist. And the lore of the racetrack was too much. You know, that's what he always wanted to do, and he went with his. He went with his calling and left geology and became a horse trainer and a very good one at that.
And many times over the years, you and Al have had the opportunity to run horses against each other, to lock horns, if you will, on the racetrack. But I know you're very good friends. I know you're cheering for each other. But once the competition starts, I would imagine all of that goes out the window.
Absolutely. I can't speak for Al, but I want to beat him every time I run against him. I mean, look, we've got – you know, all these mutual friends in New Orleans, and I think they're keeping score. So I want to be the one to get the better of him, and I guarantee he wants to be the one to be better than me. So that's definitely true. I think the hardest race that I ever had to root for Al in was when Blaine faced Zenyatta right here at Churchill Downs for the Breeders' Cup Championship. I loved Zenyatta. Oh, she was one of my favorites. You know, I mean, if you go for my top three favorites, obviously Secretariat, Spectacular Bid is a very close second to Secretariat, and then Zenyatta would be the other one. So as they're coming down the stretch and Blame is in front, I'm like, who do I root for? This would be Al's huge win, you know, but on the other hand, Zenyatta. And I ended up cheering for Al, and I couldn't stand it. I had to go to him as they hit the wire together, and of course, Al did beat Zenyatta that day, and I always kid him. I said, someday they're going to make a movie about Zenyatta, and the trainer of Blame is going to be villainous. And, you know, you're going to be the villain in that movie when they make it. So
that would be perfect.
Right.
You know, when you were talking about being somewhat nostalgic as you were watching Isolate come down the stretch, and even in the days leading up to that race before you finally reached that milestone, one of the names that you mentioned that you reflected upon was Jack Van Berg, the late Hall of Famer, who, of course, is he ranks fourth on the all-time wins list with 6,523 victories. What do you think Jack would have said if he were standing there next to you when Isolate crossed the finish line?
Well, you know, Jack was a bigger-than-life figure on the racetrack. He was a big man with a burly voice. He was a trainer a lot like today's large trainers, but there were very few like Jack back then that had divisions all over the country. You know, now you see it with Cox and Asmussen and a few others, Pletcher, et cetera. But Jack was one of the first to be like that. So Jack, you know, had a group of horses in New Orleans, and Frank Brothers ran that operation. He had another group that Billy Mott ran the operation. And, you know, in Jack's later years, we'd sit and talk a lot in the trainer's lounge at Churchill Downs, and he always would swear he remembers me. But, you know, for me, I was just a hot walker and a stable hand to Jack, of which he had many. I'm not so sure he remembers me, but more importantly, he doesn't remember just how much he taught me. The feed program I use today is the Van Berg feed program for my horses. So many trainers nowadays, you know, buy a commercial pre-made feed and just pour it in a tub and feed it to their horses. But Jack had a special mixture of different ingredients, which the main ingredient, of course, was oats. Oats is the meat and potatoes for a horse. But there were other things as well that we put in there, you know, everything from barley, bran, calf manor, flaxseed. I could go on and on, mineral salt. I mean, but the one thing that Jack's program always did was when your horses came to the paddock, they looked good. You know, they were bright colored, and brightness in coat is everything in terms of the health of a horse, and dappled out on a lot of occasions. So I took Jack's program with me when I went on my own, and his training methods too. You know, people would say maybe, I don't know, in terms of training lightly or training hard, I think the Van Berg method was probably slanted a little bit to more training on a daily basis for the horses than less. I agree with that philosophy, and I've used it for this till this day. So all the little things, I treated that time when I was working for him, both before I graduated from college and afterwards, I treated that time as like graduate school, and I kept a notebook and I took a lot of notes. And right about the time I got out of school, Frankie Brothers broke away from him and went on his own. And I went with Frankie for no other reason than that's where he was training, in Louisiana. And that was his circuit. So it was an easy circuit for me. That's where I was from. And I stayed with Frankie and learned from him as well. Before I mercifully, because the days were long and hard, got the ability to go work for the biggest vet practice in Louisiana. And as I was mentioning earlier, that's where I really learned a lot about the anatomy of the horse and what injuries you can and can go on with, and what, you know, minor things that are not a big deal versus what's a big deal and you've got to stop on. And so, you know, it was an opportunity for me to really learn the horse, and I took full advantage of that.
Did you think, Tom, at that point that you might want to become a veterinarian and leave the racetrack or be around the racetrack in that capacity?
Well, I say this respectfully, my grades weren't good enough to do that, but, but quite frankly, I didn't have an interest in that. I wanted to train horses, and I know that by the time I was done after that year with them and the time I'd spent with Brothers and Van Berg, that I was ready. I felt like I could train any horse. But, you know, I don't think the world was ready for me. I didn't have any resume behind me. No one was looking to give me any horses yet. So I went to New York, and I was an assistant in New York for a full year after that. And when I came back to Louisiana after that year in New York, it was, you know, I'm sure you hear people say this all the time, timing's everything. Brothers had left to take a private job out of the state, And so there were a lot of clients that really didn't have anywhere to go with their horses. And then the other big trainer there was C.W. Walker. He was a very talented claiming trainer, a real country boy. And I say that with respect. And Cracker was his nickname, and Cracker had a heart attack and was no longer training horses. So the two big names in Louisiana were off the board. I didn't get any of those clients from either of those guys. But when I came on the scene at that time, people weren't necessarily, you know, happy with this guy or that guy. They were still searching, and I was able to make a splash early on. It was, again, one of those things that you just have to ask yourself, is this the way it was supposed to be? I came along, I had four horses when I started, which is not enough to make a living. You got to do all the work yourself and hope that you catch on. So I had these four horses. I had one horse from the guy that took me to the wishing well back in the day. He was from Louisiana, and he told me he'd help me out. So I had a claiming horse for him. I had two horses for an owner in Louisiana that I met along the way named Mike Stevens. And Mike's family had all the concrete contracts for the state highways in Louisiana. And Mike's nickname was Crete, short for concrete, but it also had a second meaning. And the second meaning was because he was really stubborn. Mike was a very stubborn man, and he went through trainers like, you know, like a guy goes through underwear. So I knew it was going to be short-lived with Mike, but he gave me a chance. So I came to Louisiana Downs with those three horses and a horse that I pieced together six people to buy for $15,000 if I put up $2,000 each. The horse had broken its maiden at the fairgrounds, an older horse, at the bottom level. But I thought I saw something in the horse that made him a good routing horse. And he came to Louisiana Downs, and by midsummer, that three-year-old was running against older horses in a stakes race that was a mile and an eighth in distance, which was a lot of distance back then. And the race was worth $50,000. And back in 1988, $50,000 was a big stakes race in Louisiana. So I had him in there as a huge long shot. His name was Fire the Shot. And then I also had this horse of Mike Stevens, who was favored in the same stake race, one of the two that he'd given me. But Mike's horse was more of a miler, so there was a real question about getting that extra eighth of a mile. Anyhow, they both went in the race together. This is before cell phones, before you could watch the race on TV. So back then, you, Mike, you remember this, they would come around the barn area and they would lock up all the phones.
Yeah.
You could not use a phone on the backside. And then at the end of the race, at the end of the day, they would unlock all the phones. So if you wanted to know how a horse ran, you better be at that race. Well, Mike didn't attend the race. So the race unfolded, and I won with this three-year-old beating older horse at a mile and eight. Fire the Shot. Paid $16,000 for him. It was a huge win. And so after the race, I was having a beer in the grandstand with everybody. Al Stahl owned a piece of that horse, by the way. He was one of the six owners.
Okay.
And Fire the Shot, who was favored in the same race, had ran like fourth. So they always run the stakes race at the end of the day, and the day ended, and I went back to the barn. They'd unlocked the phones, and I had hired a kid that was in high school to do some barn chores and things like that. And I asked him, hey, did Mike Stevens happen to call before I got here? He goes, oh, yeah, he called. And I said, what did he say? Now, I knew Mike was volatile. And he said, well, he asked how we did in the stakes race, and I told him we won. And he got very excited. And I was like, no. His horse didn't win. The other horse won. And this kid said, oh, geez, I guess I made a mistake. Well, he said he's going to call you back in about 10 minutes. So I sat and I looked at that phone and I waited for it to ring. And when it did, it was like a time bomb going off. And I answered it. And I said, hey, Mike. And he goes, hey, Tom, we won it, huh? And I said, no, Mike, we were fourth. Well, Mike won the dummy. And Mike said, where'd that other horse of yours run? And I said, he won it. And Mike said, huh. And as I like to say now, in Louisiana, huh means you're fired. And the next day I was down to two horses. I had two horses left at the barn, and I came home from work, and I told Colleen, my wife, I said, we're done. I can't make a living on two horses. But one of the biggest owners in the country back then was living right there in Shreveport, John Franks. And he had seen the race and was like, who is this Tom Amos? guy, and he called me the same afternoon that I thought my career was over, and he asked if I'd take a few horses for him. And I did. I took three horses for John Franks. And in the next 3 weeks, I ran them all, and every one of them won. And after that, there was no looking back. I mean, he filled my barn with horses. He was my major client. I've been blessed as far as that goes.
Well, wow, what a great story, and a great way to wrap up a very fast-moving first half of the show with my special guest trainer, Tom Amos, Mr. 4,000, as we can start calling him now, after reaching that milestone back in August. We'll continue this conversation in the second half. Stay with me. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, featuring Stakes Caliber Racing and Broodmare Prospects, mares in foal to the nation's top sires, and a large selection of short yearlings. Recent graduates include Grade 1 winners Leave No Trace and Hot Rod Charlie, plus graded stakes winners Actuator and Adair Manor. The last mixed sale before the start of the breeding season, Kentucky Winter Mixed, February 6th and 7th at Fasig Tipton in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Attention horsemen, make plans now to race at Woodbine in 2023. The Thoroughbred meet begins in April, and Woodbine will distribute more than $64 million in purses. Plus, you'll enjoy world-class racing and training facilities with top turf racing in North America over the prestigious E.P. Taylor Turf Course. Woodbine's convenient proximity to Kentucky and New York, along with a 9-month racing season, make it the perfect place to compete this year. Shipping incentives may be available, so don't delay. Contact Director of Racing Tim Lawson today and visit woodbine.com for more information.
Catholic Boy, one of only three American 3-year-old colts in history to win grade ones on both dirt and turf, including the Immortal Secretariat. A 6-time graded stakes winner from ages 2 to 4, he was the fastest 3-year-old of his crop over 10 furlongs. Now his first foals have arrived. Dual surface grade one winner Catholic Boy, standing at Claiborne Farm.
There's plenty to bet on at Gulfstream Park this January with the return of the championship meet, featuring live thoroughbred racing Wednesday through Sunday and the $3 million Pegasus World Cup on Saturday, January 28th. Enjoy the races outdoors from the Carousel Club or cool off in a private suite or a restaurant 10 Paws. For stakes schedules, reservations, and tickets, head to GulfstreamPark.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Echo again in Damon's Mound, knocking heads to the quarter pole. Damon's Mound on the inside, set down for the drive. Echo again is right there. They're shoulder to shoulder off the turn, top of the stretch now. Echo again's in front. Damon's Mound is back into second. Closer's coming quickly. Here's Curly Jack. Here's Jace's Road. Here's Home down the outside. In behind it's Hayes Strike. There's one furlong to go. And Curly Jack has come away with the lead. Jace's Road rallying inside. Home down the center. Final 16th. It's Curly Jack digging in. Home trying to get by second. But it will be Curly Jack from off the pace to win it. Home was second. Jace's Road was third.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday program. Curly Jack, Travis Stone, had the call of the Grade 3 Iroquois at Churchill, and what a performance that was for trainer Tom Amos, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk this afternoon. We'll get back to Tom momentarily, but before we do, I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of the first half of the program, especially the part of Tom reflecting on what it was like to reach that 4,000 win milestone back in August at Saratoga, head back to the website, horseracingradio.net, or to your favorite podcast platform and listen to the podcast of this show, because it was fantastic and there are still plenty more content to come. Don't forget, too, you can follow us on social media at HRRN. On Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network, on Facebook, and on Instagram, and YouTube as well. Well, Tom, that performance right there by Curly Jack was pretty special, and I want to ask you about Curly Jack and some of the other top horses you've been around as we make our way through the second half of the program. But, you know, we were talking, one more note about that 4,000th career victory. Just to put that in perspective for you, and so people understand, your win total now stands at 4,011. That is just 5,902 wins behind Steve Asmussen for the top spot. Have you already worked out a strategy to try to catch him?
Yeah, I'm working on a strategy not to get lapped by him again. That's my strategy.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, before we move on to talking about some of those horses, put that in perspective. I mean, Steve Asmussen, the all-time winningest trainer in the history of the sport, I know that, you know, being in Louisiana, you've locked horns with Steve, you know, many times, not just there, but in Kentucky, in New York, all over the country. Put that in perspective as somebody who has dedicated his life to this profession. Incredible.
Crazy. It's crazy. I just, you know, it's an accomplishment that I just can't even imagine, that requires so much dedication to so many different satellite operations that Steve has in different areas and knowing those horses. And if he wasn't any good at it, he wouldn't keep the owners at those different places, but he is. He's very good at it. So just something that I would never be able to do it like the way he does it. It just, I have two kids to raise, and, you know, it just wasn't for me. But for someone that's able to laser focus on horse racing like he does, it's really a phenomenal accomplishment.
You told the story of when you were first starting out as we were wrapping up the first half of the show, and it was a fantastic story. When you were first getting going and starting your operation, and maybe there were some times where things weren't going as you had hoped they would go, what was motivating you? Were you a goal setter? Was that what was doing it? Or were there other things that were motivating you?
Well, first of all, you know, and I'm not that way now, but when I first started training at the racetrack, it was me versus the world. You know, training was a business that was handed down, you know, generation to generation a lot in Louisiana. I was a new face, an outsider, a city boy, and I didn't have a place at the table. And so everything I got, I probably pushed and shoved more than I should have to get there. You know, I was aggressive. I was tougher on myself and my help than I should have been back then. Fortunately, for me, I was able to do well early, recognize that I wasn't managing the right fashion. I wasn't conducting my business in the way I should. Don't get me wrong. I never did anything that would be something I could have gotten in trouble for. Other than I was, you know, I mean, what do I say? I was a prick. You know, I wasn't a great guy to be around. I was driven to win races. And, you know, that changed quickly, probably in about a year and a half span. And I was having success, and I was able to recognize the person I was becoming, obsessed with, you know, winning races and getting to the winner's circle. And I was letting it run my personality more than I should have let it. If I had a good day at the track, I was a great guy to be around. If I had a bad day at the track, you head for the hills. You don't want to hang around Tom Amos. But, you know, I can't say that even today that doesn't exist to some extent, but I'm able to keep it, you know, under control and not be that guy. And I wasn't that guy for long, but I was that guy long enough that I had to erase that reputation after a few years. So what drives me now is, believe it or not, is fear of failure, fear of people saying that guy's not good at his job. And maybe that sounds laughable to you based on some of the accomplishments you've so graciously said that I have, but you know, every day is a new day on the racetrack, and you know, what you have accomplished in people's eyes isn't always what we see now. So it's not like being a doctor your whole life and people seeing all this wisdom you've gained over that period of time being a doctor. Training is much different than that. There's always new people coming along and people trying to make their way. For the older guys, I mean, and I'm not here to give you examples, but you can probably think of a few in your head just regionally right here that you're like, you know, that guy just doesn't have it anymore. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, these guys, they don't forget how to train horses. It's all about having the athletes and finding ways to have those athletes in your barn. For me, I had to make a transition about 6 or 7 years ago that, you know, claiming horses was not going to be the avenue I was going to be able to take anymore, because claiming was becoming so popular with people that it wasn't just a situation where when I claimed a horse, maybe one other person was interested in that same horse. Now, when you're interested in claiming a horse, there's 10, 15 people that want that horse, so the chance of getting it are slim. So the business model had to change for me, and it did. I became someone that started going to the yearling market and started becoming very involved in Keeneland sales. We've got a method that we like to use, and I'm very involved looking at horses at the Keeneland sales. Curly Jack, who just Iroquois, is a good example of that. I bought him last year for a client. He was by a new sire, Good Magic, that nobody knew a lot about. I loved him as an athlete. He's really come through for me. So that's really become our focus every fall, to go to the Keeneland sales. I think that is that market is a very good market because they sell so many horses, and they're getting ready to do the same thing at Phasig. Phasig has their yearling sale coming up in a couple of weeks, and when you're selling that many horses, in the case of Keeneland, it's over 3,000. You just can't have one person looking at them all, and horses slip through the cracks, and it spreads out the buying and the price as well, and so you're able to take advantage of that as someone that's looking at all those horses.
Tom, those were some very honest comments about the way you were handling yourself and conducting your business early on in your career. Let me spin it this way for you. If that might be something that you would do differently, if you could go back and do it all over again, what do you think you're most proud of with everything that you've done in your career and what you've accomplished?
Well, believe it or not, I think I'm most proud, not necessarily of this win or that win, as much as I am that I always honored this business that we're in. I always tried to put the horse first, and I always, and I mean always, abided by the rules. There have been situations in my career where I had an overage for this therapeutic medicine that we're allowed to use. One stands out in particular. I had a methocarbinol positive in Indiana for 1 nanogram of methocarbinol, which is not illegal under today's rules or under HISA's rules. But in the state of Indiana at the time, they had a no-tolerance rule that was different than the rest of the nation. And because my horse tested for any level of it, any level at all, and 1 nanogram is 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram, are they considered a positive? I ended up being suspended for 45 days. That's something that really hurt. I always thought that would hurt my reputation, but I was told by people wiser than me that, you know, in the long run, it would go away and people wouldn't remember that. And I don't think they do, but that always hurt. Even today, it bothers me that a regulator thought that I was trying to do something over and above what the rules were. And I fought it for a long time. Spent a lot of money fighting it, as a matter of fact, to no avail, and I end up serving my days.
That's interesting that you say over time people will kind of – that will fade into the background, assuming that a trainer doesn't continually have those type of issues and you have not. That's interesting. It's a because sometimes I think people feel like, okay, that trainer's career is over. He's labeled as a cheater, you know, and they don't look into the circumstances and they want to hold it against a person for the rest of their career. And that's not fair.
Yeah, no, it's not. And, I think a shining example of that, and I think he'll be the first to admit it, would have to be Graham Motion, who had never had a positive and really was one of the people that was very outspoken about guys that did have positives for therapeutic approved medication that were overages. And no sooner was he like that than he fell into the same thing, and he had a positive. By the way, it was for methocarbinol, the same thing I had, and the same level, as a matter of fact, but he was over the 1 nanogram. And so he fought that for a long time, and he had a different perspective on the whole thing after it occurred to him. And look, I mean, his reputation is, I mean, you can't question it at all. Graham Motion is a horseman 100%. I would never do anything. But in a sense, as a trainer, you're playing a bit of a game of Russian roulette if you're using therapeutic medicines. We don't use that stuff anymore because we think it's unpredictable. But, remember, these thoroughbreds, they're not only athletes, they're elite athletes. My brother is the team doctor for the New Orleans Saints. And so when you're talking about these elite athletes having to go out there and compete as hard as they possibly can, which they do, you know, the idea that they don't get little aches and pains, minor things that come with training and come with racing, just like professional athletes, people also get the same things, and you don't do anything about it, that's not taking care of your horse. That's not doing the right thing by your horse. And it comes down to understanding that what you're doing is in the best interest of the horse through training, and it's not something that's so serious you're masking a problem. Those are two very different things.
Visiting with trainer Tom Amos here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Tom, let's talk about some of the horses that you've been around over the years, and in particular, your most recent graded stakes winner, Curly Jack. You mentioned what you saw in him at the sale. That performance in the Iroquois, boy, that had to bring a smile to your face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it still does. So, you know, these two-year-olds, these young horses that have only had a start or two, you know, so much goes on early in their career that makes them the horse that's the now horse or the wow horse. And then in the next instance, there's someone that overtakes them. And so, you know this from handicapping as well. A lot can change when horses transition from these sprint races to these distance races, or to put it in a different sense, a one-turn race to a two-turn race. So Curly Jack was making that transition to distance races in the air. We were really looking forward to that with him. And it went great. He showed he could raid. He showed he could take dirt in his face. And he finished up and won. And although the race itself would not be considered one of the top preps for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, which is what's coming up, you look at it closely and you can recognize a few things. Number one, Curly Jack doesn't have a great understanding of competition yet. And you can see it not only in this race, but also in the race at Ellis Park, the race previous to it, where he got beat, where he ran second. So he made the lead in that race as well. He made the lead in that race as well, and he got nailed right on the wire. Made the lead and got beat. And he actually, in the Churchill Downs race, did the same thing. He made the lead and kind of loafed a little bit. And for a second there, I thought he was going to get caught. So he's going to put that together through experience. These are kids. You know, they're not professional racehorses yet. They're raw talents. And I'm hoping that happens in the beginning of November at the Breeders' Cup. But if it doesn't, I know I've got a big three-year-old year ahead of myself with Curly Jack.
I'm going to throw a couple names out there, and you just tell me the first couple things that come to mind. Serengeti Empress.
This. Oh, my God. All-time favorite.
All-time favorite.
All-time favorite, no doubt about it. She gave me my signature win in the Kentucky Oaks. There's so many great stories behind that. Her owner, Joel Politi, and I kid each other all the time, but we're serious when we say it. She's the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, she brought so many things into my life with that win. It was wonderful.
She's also come close on a couple of occasions to giving you your first Breeders' Cup victory. How frustrating was it that she couldn't break through?
Well, you know, those races are so hard to win. The fact that she was competitive and ran so well in them without winning, I was so proud of her. I've got a picture I got from Christmas from my kids. It's after the Breeders' Cup in California, where she really ran well. And even though she didn't win, when I'm going to unsaddle her, you can just see in the picture how proud I am of her by the smile on my face as I'm giving her a pet on her neck and they're taking the tack off of her. So frustrating. You know, of course I want to win a race like that, but that's not what I was feeling after the race. I was feeling that she gave it her all, and I can't ask for more than that.
How about Mo Tom?
I loved him. So Mo Tom was for Tom Benson that owns the New Orleans Saints. And the year that I bought him at Keeneland as a yearling, he was by a first-year sire. You may have heard of him, Uncle Mo. And so nobody knew Uncle Mo was going to be any good or not. So his price was not that expensive. But it was a challenge. You know, you mentioned when Al and I compete against each other, are we out to beat one another? Of course we are. That year, Mr. Benson taking three New Orleans trainers, myself, Al Stahl, and Dallas Stewart, and giving us a budget and said, go to the Keeneland sale and get me to the Derby. And between the three of us in that given year, we put two in the Derby. Dallas had one, and I had one for Mr. Benson. So we actually ran two in the Derby that year. Al didn't have anything in the Derby that year, but he came back, and his horse was a late-developing horse that ended up being a Grade One Stakes winner and a stallion and ran in the Breeders' Cup and was one of the favorites. Didn't run well that day, Tom's the Tot. So in the very first year Mr. Benson went to the sale, he had Mo Tom, he had Tom's the Tot for Al, and then for Dallas, I'm trying to remember, but it was another stakes winner, another great stakes winner. So he did pretty darn well when he sent us out there to buy for him.
Yeah, you know, you had another good one named Lone Sailor for the Bensons, too. And, you know, you think about Tom Benson. You mentioned owner of the New Orleans Saints, and I think the Pelicans, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, owns them both. Yeah. When he passed, what type of a void did that leave for you, and what type of a void did it leave for racing?
Well, it was a lot bigger than that. It was a void to the city of New Orleans. He was so generous along with his wife, Gail Benson. They were philanthropic and gave back to the city in so many ways and to the underprivileged. Horse racing was just a small part of it. But he passed 3 or 4 days before Lone Sailor was to run in the Louisiana Derby. And Lone Sailor was a big long shot in that race. And I was doing a lot of jogging back then, a lot of running. I don't run much anymore, but I was back then, and I would go into these daydreams when I was running because I was pretty fit, so I wasn't worried about how tired I was. And he would come into my mind those days leading up to the Louisiana Derby. I just had this feeling that Lone Sailor was going to run huge that day. I ended up winning the Fairgrounds Oaks with Chocolate Martini that day, and then I came back with Lone Sailor. And when he made the lead the 16th pole, I thought, my God, we're going to win this thing. And then he got nailed right at the wire by Chad Brown, the Normandy horse. I can't remember his name fully anymore. But
Yeah. Was it Normandy Beach?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So Chad beat me right on the wire. So that was that was a big day. But, yeah, that was – his funeral had been that Friday, and the race was the next day.
And visiting with Tom Amos here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Tom, I love to ask this question of trainers on this particular program because I always get some fantastic answers. If I were to walk into your house, what type of racing memorabilia am I going to find in Tom Amos's house?
Well, you'd have to go to the basement. So I don't put a lot of stuff out. It's just not my style. But if you went downstairs to the basement, the only trophy that sits upstairs in my house, and it's not there right now because Churchill Downs asked for it back. They have a new trophy company they're using. They want to make the trophy the same way, is my Oaks trophy. And the Oaks trophy is not a big trophy. It's no bigger than probably 10 inches high. And it's a cup, a silver cup. But that Oaks trophy is up there, and it doesn't stand out. You wouldn't know what it means. But everything else is downstairs. I'm just not the kind of person that has that stuff for everyone, for the world to see.
No pictures, no saddle towels, anything like that?
No.
Or would that all be in the basement too?
Yes. Everything's down there. I'm very proud of all those things, but I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with people coming over that know anything about horse racing and feeling like they're walking in a house that says, look at me. So I just don't have any of that stuff out there.
I'll throw another name at you here. How about Heritage of Gold? Let's go back in the time machine here.
Okay, we can do that. So Heritage of Gold is a great story because it has so many legs, as great horses often do. So when Heritage of Gold was a two-year-old, she came to the racetrack and she was given to trainer Steve Penrod. And if it wasn't for Steve Penrod, Heritage of Gold would never have been the horse she was, because she was a big, big horse, and Steve recognized at two that she was not ready for the racetrack. So he told the owner that she needed to go home and she needed to wait to become a little later in her career. And that was a big disappointment to the owner, even though Steve was doing the right thing by the horse. He didn't get her back. And when the horse came back to the track, it went to Steve Asmussen. So Steve had the horse, and Steve had done well with her. He hadn't won the big race with her, but she was a stakes winner and doing well and making her way up the ladder. And there was a disagreement between Steve and the owner, and Steve lost the horse, and it went to me. So when I got her, she was already a stakes winner, and she was one of the easiest horses in the world to train. She never had physical problems, never anything at all. And I was able to really pick up where Steve had left off and get her a couple of grade one wins, my first grade one wins, as a matter of fact. But horses are – they demand you treat them right. And if Steve Penrod hadn't treated Heritage Gold right, she never would have gone on to be the racehorse she was. And Steve is retired now. He works at Churchill Downs as our paddock judge. I see him all the time. And I've never forgotten that story, that when he told me after I won the grade one with her that he had her at two. And I've always respected him for being a great horseman and doing the right thing by the horse, even though it cost him.
Oh, what a great story. Down to about 3.5 minutes left in the show, Tom. This has really flown by, and I can't thank you enough for spending this time to visit with me here on Trainer Talk today. But let's talk just for a minute about your career in broadcasting. You know, having worked with TVG and ESPN and NYRA and Fox Sports, talk about what that's meant to you and how much you've enjoyed, you know, learning and perfecting your craft on that side of things.
Yeah, so it started on a bit of a lark. TVG had just decided they were going to do a show called The Works, and The Works was going to be a show that went on for about a week and a half. And it was going to show the preparation of all the horses that were competing in the Derby and the Oaks. And they needed someone that could look at workouts and that and then describe them and tell the audience what was going on. So Jeff Lipson, who is a good friend and was with TVG at the time, he recommended me for the job. And so I got the job. I had all the knowledge of what I was looking at, but in TV, you know, you can't only – you got – not only do you have to have the knowledge, but you have to be able to express it. And I wasn't good at that yet. But they stuck with me, and I got better and better at it. And, you know, finally it became something I really enjoyed doing. So TVG gave me my start. I've always respected them for that. And then when the New York job came open for Fox Sports, I didn't pursue any of this. They asked me if I wanted to do it. I called TVG and asked for permission to do it because I didn't want to do something. I didn't have a contract or anything with them. I was just a freelance guy for them. But I still thought that they deserve to, you know, say yes or no. And they said, go for it. So I did. And I did the show the first year. And then I got a renewal on the show. And when I got the renewal, TVG was coming back to Keeneland, and I was asked by my boss at TVG, Kevin Grigsby, if I was doing the Fox show again. And he said, I prefer you wouldn't do it. And I said, well, I'll do exactly what you say, but I've already signed my contract for this year. And I got fired. He fired me right there. So he did it a polite way. He said, well, then we don't need you. So that was it for TVG. But you know what? In the end, I work with great people in the New York Racing Association. My boss, Tony Alavado, and Eric Donovan are great guys. The people I'm on the air with, they're all very, very good at their jobs. And more importantly, the way the show is prepared behind the scenes, those people, they do a great job too. So I'm just a little part of it, but I'm very proud of that show.
Well, and you should be. And, Tom, I can tell you that the sport is lucky to have you on television, and the sport is very lucky to have you involved as a trainer as well. Here's to the next 4,000, my friend. Let's keep it rolling. Really appreciate the visit here, and all the best moving forward.
I just want to tell you, it was my honor. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right, Tom Amos here, ladies and gentlemen. What a fantastic conversation. If you missed any portion of this show, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do that on Apple Podcasts or Podbean, Google, whatever it is. However you get your podcast, make sure you check it out, because that was an amazing hour with my special guest, Tom Amos. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio. For Tom Amos, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to this edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.